Hi, I'm Mandy.
And I'm Ben.
And this is Behind the Visa Window with ex-visa officers,
where we give the insider's perspective on the U.S. visa interview process.
Hey, everyone. We're back with our Behind the Visa Window podcast. And I'm here with my colleague, Ben, and we're your co-hosts for this exciting episode on the H-1B visa. So Ben, you know, I always like to think of this time between, you know, July and September as H-1B visa season, because this is when, you know, international employees who've had to really struggle and go through the whole process of finding an employer to petition for them, you know, maybe they came over here to study, they eventually got an internship with a company on OPT, and then eventually they get the company to decide to sponsor them for the H-1B visa. Do you think it's different this year? I'm sort of asking a rhetorical question because I know it is a little different this year.
Oh yeah, it's definitely different. Everything's different this year with COVID and the restrictions on travel. And then that everyone who's applying abroad for an H-1B, depending on the country that they're applying in, will have to first get a national interest exemption before they can even schedule their appointment.
Yeah. And that's really a good point, Ben. And, you know, most of our H-1B visa applicants actually come from India. And so they do need these national interest exemptions, which means that even before the visa interview itself, they may be corresponding with their embassy or consulate to, you know, to get that appointment itself. Because a lot of times if they don't qualify for the NIE, then they might not get that visa appointment.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, you can look up, we don't have to go over all the particulars right now, but there are a couple of different very, very specific criteria that that will permit somebody to be the recipient of an NIE or not. It's not just, just talk about my case and why it's personally very important to me. You need to fulfill specific legal requirements that they're reviewing, and like you need to be working in a certain industry or towards certain efforts, or it's benefiting the U.S. government in a very significant way before they will grant you that NIE. So, you know, you don't need just write and say, hey, I really would like to get this. You know, that's not really, that kind of humanitarian concern is not really what they're looking at.
Yeah, and that's a really good point, Ben. I find it interesting because then we get to this intersection between sort of the law and what consular officers are looking for. I know a lot of NIEs that are taken care of by immigration attorneys on behalf of employers and their beneficiaries. And I find it really interesting because, you know, for once we are really looking at the legal requirement, and yet it's sort of non-legal actors like consular officers who are reviewing sort of legal requests and whether that complies. And actually, you know, we've helped quite a number of people with NIE requests in reviewing them, editing them to make sure that they're as impactful and as well written as possible for the consular officer, because we tend to be, we review things differently than immigration attorneys. Do you have any recommendations for that?
I think you got to keep in mind that in the NIE decision, the same as in the visa decision, that's the final word. There's no appeal, right? There's no appeal to a different organization that's going to review this. That's going to be the final say. You can apply again in the same way, but you know, if you've already applied once with the same rationale, they might be inclined to stick with the same decision as before. So yeah, you definitely have to keep in mind that they can always rely on that old axiom of theirs that, you know, there's no such thing as a bad refusal, which we very much disagree with, but you know, they're sticking to it. So, you know, you've got to make it hard for them to just refuse you, right? Don't make it easy for them to refuse you or ignore you. Don't write them, a 14-page thesis about your NIE credentials. You know, you need to make something that's catchy, it's snappy, it's like advertising, right? They're the person that you're trying to influence, and you have a limited amount of time to catch their attention. Put your credentials in front of them and get them to make that decision to your advantage.
Yeah, that's right. And I think something else that comes into play too is, I'm curious to hear your thoughts, Ben, but I feel like consular officers tend to see the visa stamping process, the visa application process, as something that is just between them and the visa applicant. It's not really a three-party relationship where, you know, there's an immigration attorney who comes in and then there's the beneficiary. Usually we think that while we're doing the interview, we're having a very candid conversation with the visa applicant. So it's interesting when immigration attorneys get involved and they're trying to do things, you know, and zealously advocate for their client and do things in the best way possible. I actually personally think that any sort of correspondence with Post, whether it's an NIE request or an expedited visa appointment, it always is better coming from the applicants themselves, putting that forward instead of, you know, an immigration attorney, oh, I represent so-and-so and here's, you know, why they qualify. And so I think NIEs are an interesting beast because you do need to make sure that they fulfill the legal requirements. And maybe that's something that immigration attorneys can help them with, but it usually is better coming from the beneficiary themselves.
Yeah, definitely. Even the term visa stamping, that's only a term that immigration attorneys use, right? In the consulates, in the embassies, they've never even heard this term, I don't think, unless somebody is like you, is an immigration attorney in addition to being a consular officer. They've just never even heard this term, visa stamping. For them, it's no, it's the visa process. They are the ones in charge of it. And you're right. It's just between the visa officer and the visa applicant. The visa applicant may have an attorney, but that attorney plays no role. Might help them gather some materials, but you know, there's no obligation for the visa officer to interact with the attorney in any way, to address any concerns by the attorney, to respond to any correspondence from the attorney. It's just something, if they do read anything from the attorney or respond to an attorney, it's just extra.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Mm-hmm. And I love what you said about the visa stamping issue, because this was one of the first conversations that I had with Chris Richardson, Argo's co-founder, about the visa stamping term. And I think he's right. He says consular officers hate the term visa stamping. And I tend to agree, because number one, it's a term that we've never heard of. But number two, it just suggests that it's a rubber stamp process that is super easy for people to get. You go in for your visa stamp. It is a done deal. You already have your petition approved. But from what we have seen from behind the visa window, I think that's anything but the truth. You know, it is not a rubber stamp process. Yeah. It's not a stamp of any kind.
Well, I think it probably comes from the origin of the visa, where it actually was a stamp and it was probably made of rubber. You know, the old visas, you know, if you see them from the 60s or 70s, it actually is like a full large format stamp that went into the visa, and then it was filled in. The information was filled in by the visa officer. So yeah. The origin of the term probably, you know, actually had to do with a literal rubber stamp, not in the derogatory or dismissive sense that it has these days.
Yeah. And yet I think for consular officers, it's seen as, oh, you know, like something that you just expect to get. And of course, you know, for H-1B visas that we're going to talk about today, it's interesting because by the time these applicants make it to our window, they've already had their petitions approved, which is basically, you know, evidence that they're already qualified for the visa. We at the window are basically making sure that applicants actually qualify for the visa, and yet oftentimes things can kind of go wrong. And, you know, I know when I worked at the U.S. Embassy in Beijing, China, I specifically worked on the H-1B and L-1 visa portfolio, and they usually try to find somebody who's an attorney to manage this portfolio, just because there is so much legalese involved and you write a lot. You write a lot of revocation memos. So I was also the revocation officer, and I've sort of come to see firsthand exactly how somebody who has already had their visa petition approved by USCIS, the person gets sent in for their visa interview, and yet something can happen at the interview that sort of, you know, causes them to be, you know, in a pile that is not going to be approved. You know, we have to look further into the situation and ask additional questions. Sometimes, you know, the visa applicant may even be asked to come back and do a second interview in case, you know, the officer didn't feel like the first interview was thorough. So I thought that was a really interesting process to see from behind the scenes. And I think what usually causes that is honestly just a beneficiary not being prepared for the visa interview. We get these all the time because I think people are so nervous about the process. If they don't prepare and you walk up to that window, you don't realize how short of an interview it's going to be. Sometimes we get people who get this deer in headlights look, you know, because you're so nervous. And that can actually, you know, be a cause for concern for the consular officer. Would you agree with that, Ben?
Yeah, definitely. You know, there's the reasonable things that the consular officers are doing in an H-1B interview, like basically confirming that no fraud was committed in the application, right? So all the facts that were presented to USCIS in the petition for the H-1B worker have been judged to be worthy of the H-1B visa, right? You know, the credentials, the job, the labor cert, everything like that, it's all been deemed, you know, appropriate for the visa class. And the person with these documents that are legit should get this visa. So what's happening in that visa interview is that the consular officer is using their local knowledge, local expertise and linguistic expertise to confirm that the person standing in front of them does indeed have those credentials, right? And is going to do that job. So they're confirming, okay, if this person is going to be an engineer, like, did this person actually go to this school? Like, these weren't fabricated credentials or anything like that. And that's the legitimate side of what they're doing. And then they would send that back for revocation if they found that there was fraud involved. 214B, which is the catch-all for all, any reason the consular officer just does not feel comfortable and does not want to issue the visa when it comes to most other non-immigrant visa types, like a student visa, tourist visa, it does not apply to the H-1B visa. You can't just say, okay, 214B, because I don't like it, or I think they have immigrant intent. You're allowed to have dual intent with an H-1B visa. I mean, you can intend to use it appropriately now and then perhaps immigrate in the future. Now, that does not mean, though, that the consular officers will take that to heart and not delay your visa if you fulfill all the other requirements. Something that might have caused them to give you a 214B if it were an F visa or a B visa, if that same issue comes up in an H-1B application, they can just 214B you by other means, by which I mean they can just put you in 221G status and never issue your visa. They never refuse you fully, but they just never issue your visa because they didn't like something about your application, right? Mm-hmm. And something that comes to mind would be like, if somebody got a DUI in the US or something like this, basically, you know, some small infraction that visa officers oftentimes will refuse people for, even though it's not a legal ineligibility. Mm-hmm. But they might think, oh, I don't like this. I don't like that this student got a DUI when they were in the US, and they'll refuse their renewal for an F visa. Well, when it comes to H-1B, you can't just refuse them for that, but it's mm-hmm. also not a 2A1 crime involving moral turpitude. So what can they do? They can just not issue you the visa. They can just take your passport, throw it in their drawer, and ignore your emails and not issue your visa until, you know, your job offer expires and mm-hmm. the petition expires.
Mm-hmm. That is such a good point, Ben. And I think, you know, different posts do it a little bit differently. Sometimes they will have officers specifically for H-1B visas or employment-based visas, and they'll have a separate line for those people just to make the process a little bit more efficient. But at a lot of posts, like all of the posts I've worked at, you know, H-1B applicants would just come to the window the same as any other type of applicant. So you have to think about it like visa officers usually have the ability to 214B or refuse somebody. It's very hard for them to turn off that part of their brain just because this other visa type comes along and it's a different legal standard. You can't use 214B. Something that I find that happens a lot is once a visa officer is a little bit, let's say, you know, hesitant or nervous or about the visa category in some way, you know, sometimes it's like a gut feeling almost, then they start looking for reasons to refuse you or not to issue you the visa. And so perhaps, you know, they ask you a question and you have a perfectly adequate response and they're like, oh, okay, you know, this person's fine. But once they get that feeling in the pit of their stomach, and I know this is terrifying for legal practitioners where everything is based on law. And if somebody is eligible on paper, they should be eligible in person. But this is really not how it works in reality behind the visa window. When you're interviewing, you know, hundreds of applicants a day, and you get a sense from someone that doesn't come across as quite right, you're not exactly sure why, officers start looking for reasons to refuse that person. And so maybe it's not in the initial questions they ask, but then they start asking other types of questions until they get an answer that will sort of satisfy the standard for them not being able to approve your visa. And I think this is really something that we at Argo really try to help clients avoid, that situation where it takes the officer and the applicant into some sort of rabbit hole where they're just trying to find a reason to not give you the visa. And so much of it is making sure that you're prepared for this interview. You're not giving reason for the visa officer to doubt something else is going on behind the scenes. And this is why, you know, I think Ben, you've mentioned this before, but the first couple of minutes of the visa interview is so crucial to making sure that you're setting the right tone. And at Argo, we really don't believe in just having a very passive interview process where you kind of sit back, you hope that you're going to be asked the right questions that will bring, you know, the highlights of your resume to light to the visa officer. Instead, we think that you should take advantage of this very short window of opportunity, you know, just 2 to 3 minutes, and you are being very proactive in the process to let them know, you know, who you are and what you're going to do and why your job is important.
Mm-hmm, definitely. And anything that you know is going to cause a problem, you need to be ready for it, right? Well, first of all, the general advice to everybody would be know everything that's in your petition, right? Know the dates, know the numbers, know the names, know all of that, because at the time of your interview, your lawyer is not the expert in your visa preparation. You are, right? Your lawyer is not there to answer questions. You are, right? And so anything that you don't know or you contradict what's in the paperwork, they're going to think, okay, well, maybe this is fraud, right? This is just how the job works. That's what they're going to think, right? Incongruities make them suspicious. They're looking for that. That's the easiest thing for them to point at and say, ah, look, they said this, but it's this. And so then like, this person must not be telling me the truth. So you got to know all the data that's in your petition. You need to know things that you wouldn't necessarily know as just an employee. You need to know more about the company, the ownership, you know, where the company is established, is incorporated, right? You need to know all these things. And then on top of that, the things that maybe, you know, legally, you, Mandy, as an immigration attorney would say, this does not have a bearing on an H-1B visa because it's not an ineligibility. For instance, something like a three-month overstay does not constitute an ineligibility because it doesn't reach the 180 days mark. Is that right? Am I remembering that exactly correctly?
Yeah, you're
correctly?
Right.
Yeah. However, you get to that interview and they're going to look and they're going to see, oh, you have a 90-day overstay. Huh, I don't like that, right? And so they can still just hold you up in 221G you forever. That's one of those cases where it's like, okay, well, it's not an ineligibility. However, it can lead to you not getting your visa issued. So you need to be ready when you go in there. If that's something that's on your visa history, you're going to need to explain it in a way that makes that consular officer understand empathetically what was going on and why it was reasonable and why they shouldn't hold up your visa because of that, right? These are things you got to be ready for because you only get that first chance. Your best chance to connect on a one-on-one level with a visa officer and get them to see you and your goals and your life as real right in front of them is at the visa interview. If they 221G you, and then, you know, they might ask you for a document or a question later, you know, they're waiting, that interview is not fresh in their mind, a week passes, then you're just an email address that comes in with a document or a statement or something like that. And all of a sudden it's much easier for them to just, I'm just not going to do anything with this. I'm just not going to issue this, right? So it's at the time of that interview is when you really have to connect with them and show them, you know, why something shouldn't be considered derogatory in your history.
That is a really good point, Ben. You know, so if you are getting an H-1B visa, or a lot of our visa applicants who are applying for the H-1B, they have probably had other types of visas before. But if you're somebody who has had issues with, you know, a tourist visa getting refused or a student visa getting refused, it might have some bearing on your next visa application because your visa record is all connected. You're going to be able to see that in the system. And that's something you're going to be prepared. You need to be prepared to explain. And a lot of times visa officers will ask you questions that don't necessarily make any sense. They might say, you know, I see that you were refused a student visa. why were you refused a student visa? You may not know that because this is a decision made by the previous visa officer, but you're going to need to come up with a response that will have to put your case in a good light if you want to turn that situation around. And I know for the H-1B visa category, the absolute revocation rate is actually fairly low, but keep in mind that for such a short interview, you know, H-1B visas in some ways are sort of more like an immigrant visa. It's not something that you can just apply for over and over again. If you don't make a good impression the first time, like Ben was talking about, that case could be on its way to the fraud prevention unit. It could be on its way to the revocation officer, like I was, where they will put together evidence and actually send the petition for revocation to USCIS. And at that point, it will be really difficult for you to, you know, sort of fix the situation just because you were unprepared and didn't know the information in your petition and your paperwork. And just like Ben said, you are actually expected to have sort of an overview of your position, of your company, what the purpose is, how your role sort of fits into that. It's not going to be only the specifics about what you do. It might be, but it might not be. So you have to be prepared for every type of situation. And, you know, I just had an H-1B visa consultation this morning, and it was really interesting. You know, one of the things that you want to do for the consular officer is to make things as easy as possible for them to understand your situation. And for this client, one of my questions for him was, okay, what is your salary in this position? And he gave me a string of numbers. He said something like, oh, it's 62955. And I think what he meant to say was that it's, you know, $62,000 a year. And so this is something I actually corrected him on. I'm like, this is how, you know, usually we talk about salaries in the United States. We talk about it in the thousands, you know, so you can say approximately $62,000 a year. But even little things like that can really, you know, play a big role in this very short interview. If your visa officer is just trying to get through the questions, you want to make things as easy as possible for them to approve your visa, to trust in what you're saying. And part of it is just, you know, framing in a way that's easy for them to understand.
Mandy, do you have the numbers on like the total number of H-1Bs that might get fully refused each year globally, and then the number that get 221G'd?
Yeah, so I was just looking at these numbers actually, and I think the numbers that we pulled up recently for our H-1B Visa Week is from 2018, because that was before the pandemic and we can trust those numbers. But about 22% of all H-1B cases get put into 221G pending status, either for further review or, you know, documentary deficiency, or perhaps it's going to FPU for further investigations. And ultimately, the number that actually get revoked, it's pretty small. I want to say it's 5 or 6%. Mm-hmm. But if you're put into the 221G pending status, keep in mind that you know, you might ultimately not get refused, but it will delay you significantly in terms of making it in time for your job.
Yeah, that number, that final refusal number, kind of belies the fact that that doesn't mean that those 221Gs were then eventually issued. They could have just entered 221G and then never left, and they would still show up in that statistic. So, and that's indeed what happens with a lot of people. You know, they get left in that status. They may keep pursuing it, but they never get out of 221G, or they've been in 221G so long that the company withdraws the job offer, right? You know, the petition expires and it never moves forward. So it's not as low risk as that final refusal number would lead some to believe. It actually is a little bit riskier. There's no formal method for getting your case out of 221G. It's kind of, you have to be creative in each case. Honestly, with anything that's just in perpetual 221G, you have to be really creative to try to get the consulate, because they don't have to try to get them to look at it and then push it forward through the process, you know, take more action on it. Sometimes they're doing it on purpose. Sometimes it falls through the cracks. And whatever it is, you know, we have to identify what that is and find a creative way to get the consulate, that officer, that office, the fraud office, somebody to look at it and move it forward.
Yeah. Absolutely. And this is something that we discussed in our last episode as well. But if you're somebody who finds yourself in this situation, your case is stuck in 221G status, not just for H-1Bs, but for any other type of visa category, maybe there's something that we can do to help. Feel free to send us an email at hello@argovisa.com. We have been helping visa applicants problem solve their cases for quite some time now. And it always surprises me, you know, how many new issues we come across. And a lot of them we're actually able to really give assistance to visa applicants. And we're happy to help you as well. And so, Ben, do you have any sort of, you know, advice that you would give people heading into their H-1B visa interview this fall?
My advice is always, always be very prepared. And what's the way to be prepared for something that you don't understand well, that you're not an expert in? It's find an expert, right? There's intuitive knowledge, but then there's actual experience on the inside. And you know, you can't substitute one for the other.
I absolutely agree. And this is what we do at Argo. We're the world's first company of ex-consular officers, ex-visa officers, who help clients prepare for their visa interview. You know, check us out at www.argovisa.com. And hopefully we can help you be prepared for this very important interview. If you're an immigration attorney who's listening to us, we also partner with immigration attorneys to bring our service to your clients to make sure that they have the best end-to-end experience. I'm so glad that you are here with us and listening to us, and we hope to bring more interesting materials to you in the future.
Talk to you next time.
Bye.